just do an intro.
Yep. So, like about here somewhere?
Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, I'll do the intro later. I can just add that in. So, welcome to the Animation Pimp Cast, live from a hallway in Slovenia. And today's guest is the Australian animator Denis Tupikov. Tupikov,
yeah. Chris, yes, that's right.
It's Tupikov, yeah.
Actually, the Slavs say Tupikov, but in Australia it's just, my family just say Tupikov in a kind of English way. Yeah.
What does that mean, the name?
The name actually means dead end.
Really?
Really, in Russian.
Wow.
I don't know any Russian, but quite a few people have told me that, and I'm pretty sure it's right. I know it's right, and somebody told me just last week in Krakow, and they rather unkindly called me, said, you could be known as Dead End Dennis. And I thought, thanks. Anyway, just last week.
And coincidentally, you make these films that quite often deal with this...
Subject. That's right, anyway. Dead End Dennis was a little unkind, though, I thought. But, yeah, but she was joking. She was
nice.
No, she was joking. But, yes, Dead End, apparently, is what it means.
Have you come to terms with mortality? with the dead end?
No. Oh, God, no. I don't ever expect to do
films
that.
Films haven't helped you?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that. You're not... There haven't been a salve or no, not really. Sorry to disappoint you.
No, you know, I think maybe I was talking about this with somebody this week when I went through my cancer experience. Mm. Somebody had come up to me and said, "So, do you appreciate life more?" And I was like, "No, I appreciate death more." And he saw that as a negative thing, but. It was really more a case of, I'm more accepting of it.
Well, maybe I am more. I don't know whether I'm more or less accepting of it, but it's not. I don't think we had much choice about accepting.
No.
But I don't have a serene attitude to it or anything like that. And if someone close to me dies, I feel very sad.
Yeah.
So.
Did you dream of becoming an animator?
God, no.
How did you get?
God, no. I was in New Zealand once when I was about 22 or 23, and I heard a country and western song by John Prine, cool, whose work I still really enjoy. And he's still making records. He's had a brush with cancer, actually. You know, he's the cancer of the esophagus or somewhere in the throat. He lost a big chunk of his throat. But he's still going. Anyway, I heard this song, and I, although I had nothing to do with filmmaking or animation, I just thought it would make a good film, and I thought that film should be animated. So I spent the next year or something teaching myself how to animate, and I eventually made that film. But of course, the lyrics of the song are, "Please don't bury me in the cold, cold ground. I'd rather have them cut me up and pass me all around." So, you know, what can you do if you start with that? You can only go downhill from there.
was death something that was around you as a child or something?
Only probably to the extent that I later made a film about the dogs I had when I was a kid, and they always seemed to be dying, and I certainly shot plenty of birds and did the usual things that kids do, I guess, in a outer suburban kind of semi-rural environment. But I certainly as a child, no, I had nothing outside the ordinary.
Where did you grow up in Australia?
I grew up in a suburb called Darra, which is out of, which is, well, at the time was a sort of outer semi-country almost suburb, with a, but also an industrial suburb with a big cement works. And and Brisbane's kind of semi-subtropical, I guess, city about halfway up the Australian east coast. So, yeah.
How big was your family?
I had two brothers, so there were three boys and my parents. My brother, Ross, died when he was 27 and I was 22. And I'm sure that had a pretty big effect on me. But and several friends died in motorbike accidents and car accidents at around about that same time, as people, males particularly, tend to do in their teens and early 20s. But that was long after my childhood, so to speak. So, no, I don't think my childhood was very darkened by...
What did your parents do?
My father was a boilermaker at the cement works. So he'd done an apprenticeship during the Depression and things like that. And my mother was a housewife and worked in a shoe shop on Saturday mornings. So it was a working class. Background. Very sort of happy kind of working class together sort of family that... there's a lot of love and all that sort of stuff, and we had a fantastic time. I remember, had a great, very happy childhood, generally speaking. And my parents were they weren't that well educated, and they really wanted us to have better education, et cetera, et cetera. So, I was the first person in my family to go to, like, in my whole extended family, ever go to university or whatever, and
so
things like that. Mm. So I think probably our generation, I'm perhaps a bit older than you, but people who, we have a lot to be grateful for the generation of politicians and people who kind of, at least in my case, gave opportunities for public education that didn't exist for our parents.
Are your parents still alive?
No.
How did they feel about you having a career as an animator? When did you break the news to them?
Oh, well, they just heard that I was doing this stuff, and then they would see the films, and they would they were amazed, really, because they said, you never drew anything. How come you can draw now? And also, it was kind of puzzled. They were very proud of me when they won awards and things like that, but they were pretty puzzled as to where this drawing thing came from, and as I was indeed, and also puzzled about, the incidents that I talked about in the films autobiographical incidents. They knew nothing about any of that, of course, because it was all just my life as a child and the way I saw it, so, which, of course, I didn't tend to race home to them and say, gee, I saw a pre-shooter dog today. And they had knew nothing about any of this. It was just... it was quite... I think they found it quite interesting in a way that their child had... But they were really puzzled at the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when my name was in the paper and stuff, winning awards, of course, they thought it was great. Yeah. They're very happy.
What is the what's the animation landscape like right now in Australia? Like, you haven't made a film in a few years.
No. The animation landscape is very bare. Not much fruit on the trees. Not much water in the ground. And it's not just animation, but short films. In fact, short films, perhaps even more than animation. There's virtually no money, especially if you've already made one or two, or in my case, more than one or two films. There's really no money for anything much from either the federal government or the broadcasters. So we have two public broadcasters, and both of them have, they tend to turn towards series and
right.
Series of documentaries, not so much animated series, but just longer form, more convenient things rather than these pesky little shorts. You know?
So what, I guess. Well, what kind of funding would you have gotten, let's say, with Dara Dogs or?
Well, they just about all my films were funded. Well, actually, they were all funded, I think, by Screen Australia, or it used to be known as the Australian Film Commission, which is a federally funded film, you know, government funding body, which has a decent budget and so on. They were all funded either just by that organisation or that organisation in conjunction with a broadcaster, either SBS or the ABC, which are our two publicly funded broadcasters, or part funded, anyway. So they, I guess, looking back on it, if the situation was happening now, those films simply wouldn't exist. Obviously, you can sit in your garret and eat porridge and make films on your own, I guess, and. In my case, because I'm not a musician, you know, bang tin cups together to make the music or something. But mostly, you need a budget, and at the moment, that's more or less not available.
It's a bit surprising, given Adam Elliott's success
and Sean Tan more recently. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's right. And Bruce Petty back in the 70s won an Oscar as well. And a lot of other films like Anthony Lucas's Jasper Morello film was very successful. There's been a lot of them. Sarah Watts films.
That's right, yeah.
So, it is surprising. And I just feels like, just a stage where maybe these organisations have just want to rationalise. It's just easier just to deal with bigger, longer form things.
Do you have interest in, doing a feature? I mean, that's another trend that's been happening.
I do. Well, I have had for a long time. I've written several features, but they're always live action, either live action or predominantly live action. I've never had an idea that I thought was any good for an animated feature. And I take my hat off to people who can pull it off, but I haven't. I have a lot of ideas for films. I have a lot of ideas for short films, but an animated feature, I've never.
Do you prefer live action?
I don't really mind. It certainly has a lot going for it, in a lot of ways. But then animation has a lot going for it. And whatever, if the appropriate. Story or narrative or whatever you've got bothering you or whatever, I don't mind. I enjoy watching both types of films, and if given the opportunity, I enjoy doing it. I enjoy documentaries as much as I enjoy fictional films, and maybe more so.
How do you decide, though, that something? That an idea is animated or live action?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
You use rotoscope in.
Yeah, sometimes I use rotoscope, and sometimes
you're always right on that.
I don't. Yeah. But I think that's what's. It's an interesting. It's one of the interesting things about animation these days is that it is straying across into live action, and the reverse is true, of course, as well. And I think it's quite exciting because the whole idea of how you can present a film about something when nobody was there, when there was no camera there, say in the case of a documentary, or the state of mind of somebody perhaps in a more direct way than you can do with live action, which you can do it metaphorically, and you can do it with obviously all the filmic tools you have. But in animation, you can kind of do it in a direct way. For instance, so there's a whole lot of flexibility there, and the whole area of video clips for the last 30 years or something has developed a whole kind of other way of looking at. Reality or reality in a narrative musical form anyway. And I think that's part of the acceptance of animation these days is that so many people have grown up with this kind of other form of narrative that isn't based on your classic, you know, three act structure and all this kind of stuff. You know, it's a lot looser and a lot wilder, and hopefully we'll see more of it. Because I like complicated things like that, and I like to move around among different things. So anyway,
you I wanted to go back to what we were talking about on the way to this interview. You don't really care too much about the demise of 35mm.
No, I don't at all. I'm always amazed when I hear, I guess, people bemoaning its demise of film generally, because I've suffered in screening rooms when the rushes have ruined. I've bemoaned the loss of an expensive print because someone's put it through a projector badly. You know, the grain that builds up in films, the scratches, the crap, the sparkles, and there's so many things wrong with it that I just don't know how people can get sentimental. Well, I think it is sentimental, I should say. I don't know how they can get so devoted to something which I think is a passing technology, to which, of course, we're all incredibly grateful. I certainly am, but I'm even more grateful that with a digital projection, all I see on the screen as the curtains part is black. I don't see any sparkle, I just see black. And then when it fades up, I see a nice clean image. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, it used to baffle me for a while with if we were certain retrospectives we were doing, we could, you know, we had a choice between scratchy, shitty 16mm prints and showing maybe a DVD copy, and there was a period where you just, no way you could do that. I was just thinking, why? Like, the DVD looks
so much better. Especially if it's been restored, or, you know, but even if it hasn't been, it's probably been taken off a relatively clean print, as opposed to probably what you had in your other hand, which was a mess.
Yeah. Although we've had experiences this week in Slovenia where we've seen the digital projection, you know, they can get screwed up too.
Oh, and then it's really badly screwed up. Then you can't see anything at all. Yeah. No, that's right. Well, that's the other side of it. At least the film is a relatively relatively analog situation. It's real, and it's sort of chemical and optical and all of that. But digital, of course, if it goes wrong, there's no hope at all. It just goes back into binary form. So that's true. But I think the trade-off is
worth it.
It's absolutely worth it. I think.
Well, economically, I mean, it's. You know, if you're sending your films to lots of festivals, the savings of mailing, or not even mailing, you can even upload.
Just upload and download, and there it is. That's
amazing.
Right. Yeah.
When I started with Ottawa, we'd have a day and a half for the selection committee to watch films that were submitted on 16 or 35.
Mm.
Just can't imagine the cost. This is pre-selection. This isn't, for the competition.
Well, I think one of the problems, one of the reasons why I think short films particularly are seen as they can be done for less it's seen that they can be done digitally. You know, digital somehow means that they can be done for nothing or whatever. And in terms of animation, of course, digital helps a lot in various ways, but in other ways doesn't help at all. You still need to animate it. You still need to, you know, design it, storyboard design it, write it, and it still needs a soundtrack and all these things. You know, if you have good people working on it, that all costs money. But there is this sort of feeling that, oh, well, it's digital. You just point and shoot and there it is. You know, it's... no one thinks that of a feature film, but somehow short films.
What's the perception of animation in Australia is pretty much like it is everywhere. The general public thinks of it
for kids, and kids, yeah. Adam's with his Oscar, and Adam's quite a public figure in Australia, and he's very sort of well known, and he's I think he's sort of raised the. Raise the standard, meaning the flag or whatever, for animation, and he's fairly visible and does quite a lot of personal appearances and things like that, and speeches. And Marion Max's feature was pretty successful in Australia. It was screened for quite a long time. So I think all of that has.
And yet that hasn't helped the...
Well, evidently not. No, there's the, this withering away seems to have happened over that same period.
Do you teach?
I used to teach full-time back in the 90s. I taught for a few years, and I did a workshop last week in Krakow, and I do workshops around various universities and stuff in Europe and the States. But I do a little bit in Australia, but fairly small courses in Australia, so it's not too much work.
But, so how do you survive? How do you make it?
Well, it's fairly difficult. I do some teaching. I guess we own a house, so from when I was doing commercials and stuff. We don't have a lot of debt or anything. But week to week and month to month, it's pretty hard, I guess you'd say. I just have to live off whatever I've got. But I'm writing all the time, and it's just a problem being, as any filmmaker knows, the problem being in an area which costs money. If there are no ways of generating the money, you're faced with either doing nothing or doing it very cheaply and perhaps badly, or moving into an area where you can do more. Well, you can achieve what you want, and in my case, I guess that's either doing a feature film or moving into a different area completely, which is to write a book or a graphic novel or something like that. But at the moment, film, at least the sort of films that I want to do with, I guess, the production standards that I've got used to, which I like to, I like them to be well done as opposed to sketchily done. It is a challenge, and it takes more money than I have. So they're the options. I mean, there's quite a few options in a way, and I have lots of ideas and scripts that are either written or part written and all of that. That's my main preoccupation, really, is generating all this stuff. It's really a matter of what I, and when I go back probably from this trip. I really have to face up to some of these decisions, and I think maybe I am thinking about doing a book maybe combined with some designs in it. So it was probably, but that would probably be a pretty unusual book.
Like a graphic novel, or just
part graphic novel and part prose, which is probably a kind of an unusual way to go, but the particular story that I'm thinking of would be the way that I would tell it if it wasn't. But really, I'd like to tell it as a film, and I don't know that people, especially at my age, in my early 60s, that people, just deciding, after a bit of a yawn, I think I'll just turn into a prose writer. Lots of writers spend a lifetime developing their style of prose, and probably better off sticking to film. But as opposed to not doing anything, why not? I should try that. I don't know.
Are you at a So do you feel you're at a crossroads right now?
Well, I don't feel desperate, but I feel like I want to do more things, and I have a lot of these stories that seem to be perfectly worth telling. But at the moment, just because I'm involved in a enterprise which is inherently expensive and difficult, the alternative, I guess, is to do what people like Chris Sullivan have done, which is just to say, okay, I'm going to take on this enormous, this is Chris Sullivan's, his film called Consuming Spirits,
right.
A feature film that he made, I think, over about 15 years,
yeah.
And just take on this task and just roll up your sleeves and take a deep breath, a 15-year-long breath, and just do it. I don't know that at my stage of life I'm at, I don't know that I'm prepared to do that for a film of that size, but I might well start doing smaller things if I get anything else happening. Smaller things, with drawings and maybe photographs and my computer, because I it's obviously these days it's your own. If you can do a number of things, and I really can do a number of things reasonably well, you can make a film, at least the visuals part of a film, for almost nothing other than your time.
Well, we're seeing more and more independent animators turning to features. And it's fascinating being friends with some of these people on Facebook that you can see their lives are totally consumed.
Yeah.
If it's Signe Bauman and her impression film. Elliot Cohen, a former Australian.
Yes. He's
been working on a feature.
I wish them luck. I just don't think... And Chris Sullivan's film, which I really enjoyed, and it's very different, has a very different feel to your average animated film. I really take my hat off to him, but somehow I don't think that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what I'll be doing, but I don't think I'll be doing that somehow. It's just too big and too long, and probably the main reason is that I really don't like animating as such enough myself. I never have. It's a means to an end, and really it's always been that for me. So even though I can do it, I'd rather do other things. So.
And I guess it's really quite a commitment, and... Because when you're creating and you're in that zone, it's pretty amazing. But to sustain that for a feature project,
Yes, I don't know that I could do it. Also, I think from at least the features that I've seen over many years, really, usually there are, of course, life's full of compromises. But I feel like a lot of independent features I've seen have just made too many compromises, and in the end, I'd rather not do the film.
In some ways, it's a little bit sad. Not in every case, obviously, but this increase in features, it feels like a desperate move by animators in a way that.
Well, it could be. It could be. And the proof, of course, will always be in the pudding, so to speak. And if the film is a good film, then it's worth doing. And if it isn't, well, ... But that's the case with any sort of film. I just think the amount of commitment is so much greater, and it's really.
But I wonder if the commitment is out of a passion in the project, or is it. That the ego to want to get noticed more, that feature film will.
Well, that's certainly
but
that.
We don't want to just be seen as animators.
I'm sure that I'm sure there's an element of that. Of course, you know, we all have egos, and I can certainly see I've been tempted to do that, but not really seriously tempted, and I just don't, you know, I think I'd rather do something else than do a kind of film which has got people looking for the exits, you know, 10 or 15 minutes in, you know, with another hour to go, you know. But look, I wish all the people well, you know. I just don't know that I could sustain, the sort of narrative that I want to tell with the sort of power that I'd like it to have.
Right.
With the skills and the budget that would be available to me for a low budget, I just, you know, maybe I've got used to other resources or something, but I don't know. Yeah, it is difficult. And I mean, all I really want to do is make films. I mean, I'm just writing these scripts as a sort of a stand-in for filmmaking. It's I don't really write for other reasons. But maybe I should turn that inside out and look at what I've got, you know, which is a whole lot of stuff, as maybe material for other forms. I don't know. I mean, I guess the bottom line is I'd rather do that probably than do a super low budget feature. Yeah.
I think people are going to come out of the cinema now. If I should just wait till people come out.
Is it off now?
Tell me about Chainsaw, just the roots of that film.
Well, it started with me. I was at in my hometown, Brisbane, and the Brisbane Courier Mail is a fairly colourful newspaper. Usually has sort of interesting and amusing stories, and one of them was just back in the mid 90s was a report of the death of the famous bucking rodeo bull Chainsaw, who I'd heard of, and he'd been in, or an animated version of him had been in a beer commercial sometime in the early 90s. Anyway, but he died, and it was a report in the paper with a little photograph of him, and it was written in a very amusing way by a writer called Oscar Cornille, who I've never met. But, so I thought it was very funny, and I put it away in my wallet and kept it for years, really. And in the meantime, other clips came along. There was the death of Dominguín, who was a famous bullfighter in Spain. And he also died, and it was reported in the paper. And it was reported in the paper that he was a friend of Picasso's and Jean Cocteau, and but he was also the lover of Ava Gardner, who was married to Frank Sinatra when they were carrying on their affair and all this sort of stuff. So that was kind of interesting in a sort of way because of the bull connection. And then I started thinking about Chainsaw and the idea of what a chainsaw is, which, and I've never used a chainsaw, but you know, it's obviously it's a chain of little razor sharp blades which churn around at great speed and can cause a lot of damage to trees or people or anything else. And so it sort of occurred to me somehow or other along the line, this is over years, that a chain of stories might work like a chainsaw, right, so to speak. Yeah. And I guess that was a sort of idea, and I started thinking about chainsaws and things. And at some point, I did a lot of research into the lives of Chainsaw, Dominguín, Ava Gardner, Frank Sinatra, all this stuff. And I looked for material online, and I looked at rodeos and looked at bullfights. And at some point it occurred to me, and chainsaw safety films, that's right. And at some point, so I was playing around in all this area and storing up a lot of information, which seemed kind of useless. But at some point, occurred to me that I could tie it all together with a fictional story, which was a parallel to the Ava Gardner, Domingueen, Sinatra kind of triangle. And so, and once I had that, then the film seemed to take off in my head, and I could, you know, write it. Well, hopefully a kind of a fun, fairly complicated narrative, but give it a, it gave it a structure, and yeah, I was able to sort of pull it all together with that.
Did you, was that the first time you worked with actors? I'm trying to think.
No, I've worked with actors. I've directed actors in, I made a short many years ago called The Bear, and I have also worked, obviously, with voice actors. I also worked with two terrific actors in a film called His Mother's Voice.
Right.
The actors were miming to, I used the original radio interview, but I got these two actors to act while miming to playback, which is, you know, quite an unusual thing to do, and quite difficult, but they did a fantastic job. So no, I work with actors quite a bit. I used to do a bit of acting when I was at, you know, performing art school many, many years ago in the early 70s or mid-70s. I love working with actors, and I think they're recently, well, not recently, a couple of years ago, I made a documentary about the French photographer Nadar and his interview with a famous 100-year-old scientist called Chevreux. And in doing that, I worked with a couple of actors in France to do the voices, and then we did the live action with a couple of actors in Australia, and they also they mimed a playback, but in a much, much more extended way. And I quite like doing it, and I mean, sure, it's extremely tough for the actors, and technically it's very demanding, but they've always been really good about it, you know. They like, and they prepare incredibly well, and it's always been a really good experience.
Have there been times where they've added something to the, you know, to the creative, to the process that's,
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, when they're miming to playback, it's a bit difficult to add too much in the way that you normally would with voice or timing or whatever, because the voice and the timing is set. That's why I guess I really admire the fact that they've come on board and done it with such good grace, really, because you are limiting them in so many ways. Look, I have a lot of respect for them, and I tell them up front that this is the way it's got to be. But of course, there's a whole lot of other things they can bring to it with their visual, their sense of what they're bringing to the role visually. And for instance, Laverne McDonald, who was a friend who sadly died early this year, she played the role of Kathy Easdale in His Mother's Voice, and she did a fantastic job of inhabiting the role and acting with her face and her hands, and then, you know, crying and all sorts of things, which I asked her to do, but only a really skilled actor could do all these things with her, with her whole body, really, while at the same time miming extremely precisely to somebody else's voice. It's amazing to me these people could even do this.
Which, when you look back at your body of work, which film are you most satisfied with, regardless of, you know, what won awards or didn't?
Yeah. Probably either probably His Mother's Voice and Chainsaw. Those two probably are the ones that I'm most happy with. Chainsaw, I guess, because it's, you know, it's kind of complicated, but it seems to work in the way that I, well, both of them, I suppose, are a bit complicated, but they work in the way that I hoped they would, and I wasn't ever sure that they would work in the way that I meant them to work. His Mother's Voice, because it's told twice, and not many films use the same soundtrack twice, and I didn't know how that would work. And Chainsaw, well, just cause it's kind of complicated, and whether people would hang in there for it. And I think both of them are, you know, done well enough to sort of keep people interested and aren't boring and have, you know, decent soundtracks and that sort of thing. So I guess they're the two films that, I don't know, between them, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I suppose one, you know, His Mother's Voice is probably more emotionally involving, but that's really down to Kathy Easdale's voice and storytelling. Yeah. It doesn't have a lot to do with me.
What's been the most successful film?
Oh, well, at festivals, Chainsaw, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Although not in Australia. Chainsaw won a lot of awards around the world, but almost nothing in Australia at all. And on the other hand, His Mother's Voice won a couple of awards in Australia and nothing much anywhere else. Or in fact, nothing anywhere else. So that's the way it goes. But all my films have been on television, and those two films have been on television both in Australia and I think England and France, and so.
Where would they show on television in Australia? Not on Cartoon Network.
Sorry?
Not on Cartoon
no,
Network.
No, probably not Cartoon Network. Well, Chainsaw was partly funded by a broadcaster, so they put it on, of course. It was shown, about 9:30 at night. Pretty good time slot, I think. And His Mother's Voice was just straight out funded by the Australian Film Commission, so it didn't have a broadcaster involved, but it's actually screened quite a bit on Australian television over the years. You know, it sort of has a... I don't know when it's going to be broadcast. And then people will contact me saying, oh, "I saw this film the other day or whatever." And they've screened also in other countries. So,
all right, I think we should just stop
there. Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Dennis. Here we go. I'll edit all this.